Welcome to the Global Council podcast, where you can hear the GC team discuss and debate topical developments in public policy and regulation from around the world.
Good morning, and thank you everyone for taking time to join us today for our discussion on doing things differently in the UK and the EU, today looking at energy policy. My name is Tom White. I'm one of the directors of Global Council, responsible for our Brussels office and also for our advisory services on highly regulated sectors. I'm joined today by my colleague, Edmenegilda Boccabella, our advisor on energy and climate change, normally in our Brussels office, but today speaking to us from Berlin, as well as my colleague, Lila Howson-Smith, senior associate in our UK practice, with a long experience of working on UK policy and politics from our London office. What we were going to do today over the next 45 minutes is look at a subject area of energy policy, which, to be honest, has never been more interesting. We have huge questions facing politicians and policymakers about how to meet really ambitious targets for decarbonizing power generation, as well as the wider economy, where energy, of course, plays a crucial role. There is talk of revolutionary new technologies in areas such as hydrogen, carbon capture and storage. And at the same time, we have a greater awareness of some of our vulnerabilities from our international interdependence for energy. Overlaid across all of that for our discussion today is also the reality that the UK is now fully outside the EU's regulatory ambit for questions of energy policy. And that's going to be the focus of what we look at today. We're going to be looking at how the UK might do things differently in areas such as accelerating the deployment of renewable energy. We will look at some of the regulations and ways in which decarbonisation will be incentivised. We'll also look at some of the fiscal tools that are available on both the UK side and in the EU, in part following the new consensus about government activism after the pandemic. So quite a lot to cram into our 45 minutes. I'm going to start the discussion today looking at the question of renewables, where we've obviously seen transformative increases in deployment and decreases in price. It's also an area where, to be honest, even when I worked in the UK government, there was always a bit of divergence in the UK's approach, partly flowing from its natural resources, which were previously North Sea oil and gas, and more latterly, offshore wind power, but also the difference in the economic needs with a smaller industrial sector and a greater focus on household consumers. But perhaps, Edmenegilda, I could start with you and think about the EU 27 side of the equation. When you look at the ways in which renewables are looking to be increased, accelerated, what do you see as the main objectives and challenges on the EU side?
Well, the main challenge is essentially, and this is a problem, an issue not just for the EU, but also for the UK, it's a shared issue of you set goals to significantly scale up and increase the amount of renewables that you have, especially in the offshore space, but you now need to start implementing those sorts of projects. So you need those projects to come online. They need to be approved. They need to be fast-tracked. You need to already have a very good idea about the sorts of locations where you want those projects to go. You need to have an idea about the grid capacity which will support those projects. And that's really challenging because in an ideal world, that's a process that you would take, you know, you would have 6 years of proper assessment, also your normal sorts of environmental impact assessment, those sorts of things. You have to fast track that now. We have really significant emissions reductions targets on both sides, in the UK in particular, but also in the EU. And to be able to meet these targets, you need to be fast tracking projects, getting them online as quickly as possible, reducing the amount of red tape, But on the same side, in the same light, you also need to balance out that you don't want to be rushing into projects that might not be suitable. You obviously don't want to, you want to minimize the amount of damage that you have to local environments and to local communities, and you want to maximize the sorts of economic benefits and benefits for wider society when you're making these decisions. Making them quickly, though, isn't the most effective way to kind of tick all of those boxes.
And I thought the sense of urgency was something that really came across in the event we held a couple of months ago with Executive Vice President Timmermans. And it's clearly woven through most of his public speeches, as well as those of Kadri Simpson. But when you look at that challenge in the EU, you know, how much can really be done at the EU level, and how much do we need to focus on the member states themselves and how they operate within the frameworks that are set?
Yeah, exactly. And this is the challenge. The EU can set their targets and their goals. Their offshore renewable energy strategy has really great renewable energy targets, both in the short term, but also in the long term. The real key thing here, though, is making sure that member states can implement and have the sorts of project pipelines that will get us to reaching those targets. We've seen a huge amount of technology that is being that on the board for areas like the Baltic Sea, where you've got some really interesting joint ventures which are happening. You have a lot of really great European champions when it comes to the renewable sector in particular. And they're also working across the channel with the UK as well. A lot of the names that we see on projects, we're seeing the same sorts of people who are investing in projects in the EU, in the UK, certainly looking at getting these projects off the board. But they still require that the support on the ground. You still need to be able to meet all of the domestic and member state requirements when it comes to things like planning permits and all of the things that are really integral that still have to be managed at a member state level. So you can, in some ways, you can try and to accelerate it as much as you want at the EU level. And I think certainly the rhetoric is there, and we've seen strategies. We don't necessarily have the same sort of policy push, that we don't have policy on the books. We don't have drafts to be poring over yet. So if we want the EU regulation to change, then we need to start seeing some of those proposals in front of us. But certainly when you're looking at the sorts of projects where they're happening, the opportunity is there, but we just need to make sure that the urgency that we have at the EU level is also felt at the local level as well.
Absolutely. I think that's an interesting point to look at the UK, which obviously now has been able to focus very much on what it can do. It no longer has to worry about the interplay between national and supranational to the same extent. So, I mean, Lila, would you say that this ambition is the same in the UK, or how is it different?
Sure. So I think if we're talking about the UK and about both kind of green technologies and renewables, the government's kind of overt priorities are CCUS, hydrogen, onshore wind, which is kind of a continuing priority, as you mentioned, kind of has been a government priority for a while. But all of these are kind of chosen because there are clear opportunities for green jobs, and CCUS and hydrogen in particular offer possibility of a kind of neater transition for North Sea oil and gas. And in terms of appetite, I think the government gets that there's political capital to be gained here. If the UK expands its renewable capacity, technologies and infrastructure, there are kind of political wins both on a diplomatic stage and at a domestic level. And I think this was kind of really deliberate in Boris Johnson's 10-point plan in how it was positioned. And I think we have to remember, particularly with that document, it came at a point where there'd been quite limited bandwidth for anything other than COVID. So this was a kind of real marker in the ground. And they wanted to set out a strategy rather than a policy document to show both how renewables and how the green agenda was going to fit in with their domestic priorities around levelling up, but also their wider ambitions for global Britain post-Brexit. So I think we've kind of seen similar positioning on the UK side, but with slightly different priorities. I think what is clear is there's still the gap in terms of the actual regulation and the funding models, which kind of equally in a similar way to the EU possibly haven't kind of been forthcoming. I think some of that is COVID and some of that is bandwidth and some of that is kind of getting used to sort of reprioritizing the domestic agenda again. But I also think some of that is perhaps a lack of kind of joined up thinking at UK government level, kind of between departments.
Yeah, of course. I suppose actually you're mentioning of the difference between the UK-wide policy, and of course there are devolved administrations, which is a good qualifier to my point before about the UK now having complete control. I mean, certainly the political calculation is clear that, you know, if you can find a win-win that is finding new industries in potentially in former industrialized areas, if you are demonstrating global leadership and sort of undermining some of the accusations that have been placed at the UK that in Brexit it is, you know, turning away from the world, you can see the political calculation is very clear. For many of our clients, and I'm assuming also people on this call, we're also concerned about what the practical barriers might be to actually delivering on that vision. And you mentioned funding and you mentioned regulation. What would you see as the most significant hurdles to realising the ambitions?
So, yeah, I think it's funding, but it's particularly kind of funding models. So it's okay, if we want to attract private sector investment, kind of what's the win-win? Obviously, we've seen how successful Contracts for Difference were in the offshore wind sector, but kind of is there an opportunity to do something similar on hydrogen? And I think that's definitely in consideration, but ultimately the government's kind of scheduling those funding models to be consulted on over summer. You're kind of letting a timetable drift quite a lot, kind of in advance of already having set some quite sort of punchy targets, both for 2050, but also for 2035. And I think that's kind of a key barrier. I think there are areas where progress has been made, definitely. So you've kind of got BEIS about to kind of consult on the first set of carbon cluster projects, which was obviously kind of one of the key areas where they're kind of taking forward industrial decarbonisation. And you also have had the energy white paper, which kind of puts some flesh on the bones in terms of specific priorities and how these might be integrated. But the government needs to show kind of sustained interest and follow this through with funding models to show that there's a kind of pathway to net zero and the UK being a world leader in this. And I think the thing that's going to be instructive is kind of where have they been successful before? So obviously offshore wind is the clear example of that. But are there kind of other areas, maybe outside of kind of energy policy, where they can look to, where they've kind of incentivized transition in the private sector?
So we're looking at a mixture of more directional infrastructure deployment, as well as looking at, you know, the success of previous market mechanisms. And you mentioned Contracts for Difference. I mean, maybe if we come to one of the biggest market mechanisms in the world, which is the use of the EU's emissions trading scheme. Maybe, Edmond Adjilda, we could come back to you and look at how is the ETS likely to be reformed, and how does what's being discussed in Europe measure up against those ambitious targets that we talked about before?
Yeah, well, the ETS, I mean, it's extremely interesting because there's an ETS in the EU, there will be an ETS in the UK, that we already know, the legislative structure is already there. Both the UK and the EU have a net zero 2050 targets, and the ETS will be a really important tool to be able to get there. Today, for the first time ever, the EU ETS hit more than 50 euros a tonne, which was the sort of number of carbon dioxide pricing that we could only dream of. It will be extremely important to be able to help the EU achieve its own targets. So we have the 55% emissions reduction target by 2030, which was agreed to. We have energy efficiency targets, which the of 32.5% for 2030, which the carbon price will help feed into. We have offshore renewable energy targets at the EU level. It's to get 60 gigawatts of offshore capacity, which will explode to 300 gigawatts of offshore capacity by 2050. We've got really clear green hydrogen targets of 40 gigawatts by 2040, and even having 6 gigawatts of green hydrogen capacity by 2024. We've got different member states, even when it comes to hydrogen, for example, Scotland has its own hydrogen strategy with a clear hydrogen capacity goals. The EU wants to be able to produce more than a million tons of hydrogen by 2024 and then 10 million by 2030. The reason why the ETS in both countries is really key is putting a price on carbon is driving these technologies, the offshore, the energy efficiency, the green hydrogen. It's increasing the economic support for these sorts of projects. All of a sudden, if carbon is that expensive, you're then going to start looking at other options. And when you're investing in other options, whether it be energy efficiency, whether it be increasing your renewable capacity, or whether it be using green hydrogen, then the price of those new technologies will start to drop. We already know that the cheapest way to produce an electron now on the planet is through photovoltaic solar power. What we will see is that the economies of scale which will grow around these other technologies will make these technologies more accessible, and the way to kind of make that even faster is to ensure that old technologies which emit a lot are priced based on their emissions. And that's something that both the EU and the UK have to be able to do kind of in gusto together.
So some very big numbers in the future, and a lot of I get a strong sense of opportunity. But if we look at the actual decisions that have been taken so far between the UK and the EU, the one that stands out most clearly to me is the UK's decision not to try and pursue a linking of that ETS scheme. So putting to one side all of the positive politics around the energy transition, doesn't this really undermine ambitions on both sides to really use the carbon price to drive change in the market?
Yeah, I think certainly 12 months ago we thought that a linked ETS was a given. We thought that by this stage we would have a linked ETS, and that you'd certainly be able to build on kind of carbon trading between the two countries. I don't think the UK's approach, and of course I'd love to hear Lila's point of view on this. I don't think the UK is actively not pursuing it, it's just not being prioritised. And that is detrimental to business because it leaves a huge amount of kind of confusion on the side of business. There is an entire financial market that's developing around generating carbon credits, whether it's on a voluntary scheme or whether it's in a compliance scheme. But you're essentially missing a year of opportunity that you didn't have to miss. I'd love to hear Lila's take.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think there were two kind of clear factors sort of working against both the UK and the EU, but particularly the UK, on getting towards a linked ETS. The first was kind of the window to get an agreement on this once the Brexit deal had been done in advance of the first auction was quite small. And I think there's just a kind of, there's a reality to that. And secondly, I think the problem was kind of when this was being initially discussed as part of the negotiations, there was a kind of wider internal conversation within the UK government about carbon pricing, and specifically like the Treasury were interested in a carbon tax and BEIS were interested in a kind of linked ETS or something around that. So I think that was playing out rather than perhaps the kind of necessary consideration between kind of the UK and the EU around whether this was a real possibility and whether this was what they were aiming for immediately after the Brexit deal had been done. I think obviously don't need to say it, but Brexit was a kind of high stakes game for the UK, and specifically for this UK government. And I don't think they necessarily joined the dots on this at an early stage. And I think this is possibly a sort of broader issue for the government. While net zero is a clear ambition, they don't necessarily always have the central coordination behind it because you don't have a Department for Climate Change. You have BEIS basically leading this. It's not always clear that BEIS are necessarily feeding into David Frost's team in the Cabinet Office who are negotiating with the EU side. I'm sure there are people in Number 10 thinking about these issues and kind of trying to join up these dots, but I think in a kind of short timescale, it's perhaps not surprising that sort of a specific push was made for this. And I think now the UK is kind of moving to frame their standalone ETS as a kind of mechanism for them to be more ambitious and kind of get them into a kind of wider conversation about carbon pricing. And I think I'd be kind of interested in Menagilda's thoughts on this, but there's a kind of opportunity potentially for the UK to expand the scope of their standalone ETS to show a greater level of ambition on this. The problem with that is for the sector, there's a kind of real lack of alignment between the two ETSs if that was to happen.
I think we definitely want to come back to this question of ETS linkage, and in particular whether COP might create an additional bit of momentum around that. I did want to pick up on one of the points that we mentioned earlier, which was around the UK having in some ways set even more ambitious targets than have been set in the EU for carbon emissions reductions, certainly sort of the timeline for getting to net zero, as well as some of the interim milestones. But that slightly pushes up against some of the politics in the UK in recent years about energy bills and about the burdens on the consumer. And I just wondered, as the UK is also looking at having greater autonomy over its VAT, over its consumer regulations, do we think we'll see any changes on that side? Will we look at ways to reduce prices and ease burdens on households? And if so, how does that compare with the climate change ambitions?
Yeah, so I think this is a really interesting question, because kind of VAT is definitely one way of kind of reducing the cost of electricity. It remains kind of a wider odd feature of the UK energy pricing model that electricity has more policy costs heaped on it than gas. And I think they need to kind of fix that if they want people to expand their use of heat pumps, and also if we continue to sort of produce more renewable electricity. So yes, VAT on electricity should be considered. But I think it's not perhaps the same conversation we were having in sort of 2016, when some of these debates around where we could reduce VAT to incentivize different kinds of consumption were happening. I think the government is beginning to consider the wider financial incentives and disincentives around energy. So I think another mechanism, yes, would be to kind of even out policy costs on electricity versus gas. That's not to say that kind of VAT isn't a powerful tool. And in fact, it'll be kind of interesting to see whether the government looks at VAT on the retrofitting of individuals' homes for energy efficiency measures in the kind of forthcoming heating and building strategy, because they kind of haven't up till now been able to find kind of clear ways to incentivize take up of energy efficiency measures. The recent Green Homes grant was kind of another example of this not particularly being very successful. So I think there's definitely opportunities, and I don't think it's always the case that these weren't things that they could have considered inside the EU, clearly, but there's a kind of new way of thinking about these things, which I think is quite helpful, as you say, if the UK is kind of intent on setting such ambitious targets, you know, rightly, but kind of how they actually think about delivering this.
You mentioned about new ways of thinking around, you know, looking even at the demand side and looking at buildings. And I mean, there's also a lot of discussion in the UK about electrification of vehicles and, you know, increasing demand for different types of power. I mean, we've also seen, I mean, Adilda, on the EU side, some very creative thinking over the last year. You mentioned about the recovery funds being deployed to green energy, and we've looked in the past and some of our work at what the EU is currently focusing on around buildings and the approach to improving energy efficiency. I mean, what are you looking at on the demand side in the EU? Where do we see sort of policy innovation developing there?
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, there's a huge amount of policy that's forthcoming, especially with the Fit for 55 review on the EU side. What's really interesting is the challenges that the UK have are very, very similar to the challenges that the EU have. But the UK now has the opportunity, or now has to essentially go at these alone. Heating is quite an interesting one, especially when you're looking at the energy efficiency and energy performance of buildings. It's a problem that's shared both within the UK and the EU. We have similar climates in the UK as we do in the EU. We have similar life expectancy of our building stocks. Our building stock normally lasts for about 150 years. And for a lot of buildings in both the UK and the EU, they haven't been built with energy efficiency as like their primary principle. So you're now looking at a very, very large retrofit job. And what does that look like? You know, should we be delivering, heat pumps to every household? Is that one way of doing it? How do we look at improving the energy efficiency of buildings? We've seen massive programs already, like in France, you had the Relance France program. What's been interesting on the UK side is the push has been a little bit less. In the EU in particular, lots of member states have seen things like the renovation wave, things like getting people back to work. I think last year I said the word shovel ready projects about 150 times a week, because what people were looking for were the sorts of projects that you could deploy immediately. And so when you're looking at recovery, those are the sorts of projects that are kind of labor intensive, where you're getting people out, you know, working. They're challenges that both the EU and the UK face. Again, it's a mixture between how are you going to direct public money, whether into these sorts of projects, how are you going to make sure that these projects that these projects are disseminated appropriately. You have some issues in the UK where energy efficiency work is done by voucher, which then creates a bit of a bottlehead, rather than being able to claim it as a tax break, which you can see in other jurisdictions like in Germany. So it's really important to make sure when you're looking at these programs that they're accessible, that they're understandable, and that they don't create another layer of bureaucracy, so that you're able to keep the cogs turning effectively.
I mean, that is one of the arguments that the UK was deploying to be able to be more nimble and more quick-footed in taking opportunities. I mean, if we were to maybe think about what incentives the UK is deploying, Laila, I don't think there is the same sort of fiscal stimulus planned in the UK, but there has been some quite eye-catching announcements about investment incentives in the tax system. Would you maybe tell us a bit about how those could play out for energy consumption?
Yeah, sure. So I think the kind of simple answer is that basically you haven't seen the kind of investment incentives that have been put in place in the UK, like the super deduction, having the same type of green strings attached as some of the EU projects. And we've actually seen funding for green home improvements withdrawn, although that's been compensated for by kind of a focus on public sector building improvements. I think this is a problem because there's clearly, as the EU's recognised, an opportunity to think about how you direct not just public money, but private money too. But I think it's also a mistake to think that no one's thinking about this. I think ultimately what has happened so far is the Treasury has been fixated on economic recovery and the economic support measures that have been in place throughout COVID, kind of at the expense of everything else. I think they missed a bit of an opportunity with the super deduction, but it's not quite true to say that no one's kind of thinking about this. The Treasury's got their kind of net zero review coming up, which they published a sort of interim statement for a couple of months ago, but it's specifically looking at how you balance costs and benefits and look at fiscal tools on your pathway to net zero. And I think that's kind of forcing the Treasury and government more widely to kind of confront and consider these issues. You've also got the likelihood of another UK fiscal event just possibly a couple of months before COP, which I think is going to kind of focus minds on how better to use these kind of fiscal levers. And I think fundamentally they sort of know that if you don't start sort of putting in place clear incentives and fundamentally funding, you'll get a credibility gap emerging in advance of COP, which is obviously kind of a huge moment for the UK government.
Well, I, I think we've explored quite a number of areas where the UK and the EU will diverge, not even by design, but just through the realities of how they're going to be developing and consulting on and implementing policies. We've got a few questions from the audience to come back to, most of which relate to actually the global picture. But before we do, could I maybe just ask a quick question of both of you, which is that based on your experience of working in both jurisdictions, you know, how realistic do you think it is that all of these high level targets will actually be delivered and implemented? I know from my own experience setting climate change and energy targets for 2020 that performance on delivering them was sometimes more by luck than judgment, and was often quite patchy, both in the UK but also among some EU member states. You know, do you think this time we should take the political targets at their word?
So just beginning with the UK, my concern isn't, I think it depends on which sector you're looking at. I think ultimately in industrial decarbonisation, I think the UK's got kind of good intentions and the right policy to kind of sit behind it. I think the focus on kind of carbon capture and storage is right. And I think they are kind of, that's the area where they are directing funds. My concern would be on heating and buildings, where the UK hasn't really wrestled with the dilemma of whether you're going to rely on hydrogen or heat pumps, and specifically wrestled with the kind of necessity of quite disruptive change to consumers' homes, which is going to be difficult, and you're going to have to really sell the benefits of this to consumers. And I just don't think we're anywhere near kind of on that path. And I think it's important to remember that a lot of the emissions reduction that has come before has not been very visible to consumers or businesses, partly because it's mainly been in the power sector, and also because the UK government has directed a lot of funds towards it, rather than kind of relying on the private sector and also relying on individuals making active choices.
Yeah, I think on the EU side, I mean, the advantage that the UK has is that the UK can target policies to address the areas that it is lagging on emissions reductions. The disadvantage, of course, is they can't rely on Sweden and Denmark to pull them across the line collectively, which is what has been happening at the EU level. The EU has been able to reach all of its emissions reductions targets. The only one that it's failed and really struggled with is energy efficiency, but that's because they've been doing it collectively. Certainly, there are a number of member states that fall below the line and that haven't been able to individually meet the sorts of targets. And we saw that was a key issue when we were looking at the European climate law that had, you know, a huge amount of trilogues for a piece of legislation that in principle was meant to be, you know, relatively agreed on. The sticking point at the end was whether or not we were going to have a collective net zero, a net 55% emissions reductions target, or a gross 55% emissions reductions target, and we ended up settling on the lesser. The big issue for the EU is that the EU has to regulate for every sector. The EU has to regulate in particular transport emissions are an area for the EU where emissions increase. However, transport emissions are nowhere near as much as a priority, as Lila points out, for the UK. Home heating and the performance of buildings is, and you know, as Lila pointed out as well, it's disruptive. It's not just, we're not just talking about, you know, are we ripping out your gas heater and we're putting in heat pumps? You also have to, you know, have a full insulation program. You have to replace a huge amount of windows and doors. That's expensive, and people, it will annoy a lot of people. It's not going to be, people aren't going to be as happy about it, especially if you've, you know, if you're living in a home and you get a council note that says, by the way, your house is class D. That will annoy a whole lot of people. The big difference, though, between the UK has a really progressive emissions reductions target, and I've said this before to colleagues, this is one of the, you know, if there are positives from Brexit in particular, no one would have thought when Brexit came out that in fact one of the results would be the UK would have a far more ambitious emissions reductions target than the EU. And let's be honest, that's actually a really, really good thing. the UK being able to deliver that, that 78% emissions reductions target based on their 1990 base level year by 2035, that means that they need to start implementing. They've pushed it out beyond 2030, probably because they know they won't quite make it. But that means the sorts of technologies that we're talking about that will get them there, they need to be going into place within the next 2 years.
Yeah, so we can all look forward to breathing that London air in 2035.
It will be fresh.
I'd like to come to some of the questions that we've had. I'll need to group them together, but they all relate to the sort of global picture. And the first one is the old chestnut of carbon leakage. And a question of, you know, if the UK and the EU are both moving faster and more ambitiously than the rest of the world, how will they protect the competitiveness of their industries? Given we were talking before about the ETS, maybe Amnedjilda, I'd come to you first and then to Lila.
Yeah, so the carbon border adjustment mechanism is something that the European Union has been talking about since, I think it was December when it first got mentioned, December 2019. So we're now 18 months in. We have seen the draft agenda of the College of Commissioners, and it looks like that the details of the carbon border adjustment mechanism will be released on the 14th of July this year. Interestingly, and this is something that Lila and I talk about quite a lot when we're doing our compare and contrast, the UK has been really, really quiet on what they're going to do with whether or not they want to approach a carbon border adjustment mechanism. I've jokingly said that they're kind of standing there, not shaking their head, not nodding, but slightly moving so that they look really ambiguous. I think the EU is going to continue to pursue a carbon border adjustment mechanism. I've said this before at the beginning, I thought that the carbon border adjustment mechanism was really meant to be a warning shot for both China and the US. I think the metrics have changed significantly because you now have net zero commitments, mid-century net zero commitments, more or less from both of those countries. And something like a carbon border adjustment mechanism will really look at places like India, where they're still using quite emissions intensive industries that are genuinely competing with industries in Europe and in the UK. That makes for an interesting quagmire because the original thought of the I don't think when Dieter Jørgensen first spoke of the carbon border adjustment mechanism, if a savvy journalist had said, you know, are you targeting India? She would have said, no, of course not. But now that looks like what it is. How the UK approaches that is going to be interesting, especially because the UK has come out and quite strongly said that they want to pivot towards the old relationships that they've had in the Indo-Pacific region, and how they use a carbon border adjustment mechanism in those sorts of circumstances creates a lot more questions, I think, than answers.
I just say, yeah, I mean, I agree with everything Amnedjilda said. I think the UK government really hasn't made their mind up yet on this. I think that's what the debate over the Cumbrian coal mine showed in part. The UK doesn't have a good answer yet on whether it's better to import less coal but from China, or set up a coal mine that serves a local area and local businesses and provides employment. That then kind of goes to the secondary question, which you need to answer if you're going to kind of seriously think about a carbon border adjustment mechanism. I think the reason it's a specific challenge is that the voter coalition that the Conservatives came to power on in 2019 is not going to accept that going green means that we should abandon jobs in the Northeast or accept that there's going to be kind of particular dislocation. Part of the Conservatives' appeal to them in their kind of slogan of levelling up was that they already feel that they've lost out from globalisation. And I think it's an interesting sort of dynamic in which to then play in the carbon border adjustment mechanism. I don't think there's kind of yet any sort of serious intent behind it kind of within the UK government. I think, like Amnedjilda says, they'll watch from the sidelines, but you are getting Conservative MPs who are interested in this issue talking more about how you wrestle with the challenge of an ambitious energy transition that doesn't necessarily kind of impose more burden on businesses or kind of sort of deliver the death knell to the steel industry, for example. And I think that's it's a really important debate, and I don't think it will go away. I think the UK government will just choose to kind of see how it plays out in the EU context, and how particularly what Biden chooses to do on this.
Thanks. So if we look at maybe time for one more question, I'll bring two together in cheating a little bit. We've got one about open strategic autonomy as the new EU economic doctrine and how that will play out for the energy sector. And we have a question about the role of Chinese investment in the energy sector, both in the EU and in the UK. Of course, it's slightly different in that we have a number of EU member states signed up to the Belt and Road Initiative. Clearly, energy infrastructure plays a part in that. We have Chinese investment in energy assets, particularly in Portugal and in Southern Europe, and at the same time in the nuclear sector in the UK. I suppose I'd bring those together by just saying, you know, how will the politics of national security or European security play out in the energy sector over the coming years? Maybe Lila, given that we recently had a UK defence review, I'll come to you first.
Yeah, I think this is a really important question, and I think ultimately, kind of, particularly UK Chinese involvement in UK nuclear is kind of the next battle for Sino-skeptic MPs in the UK Parliament. I think, you know, obviously, I think Hinkley Point is possibly sort of too far progressed for this to be challenged, but I think we should be clear that there's going to be a battle over kind of Chinese involvement in Sizewell. And I think the problem for the UK government is they don't necessarily yet have kind of the policies in place and the funding mechanisms in place around kind of nuclear and other renewables to attract other kinds of private sector investment. But certainly, you know, the National Security and Investment Bill, which was passed into law last week, will kind of provide a screening mechanism for any Chinese involvement in energy infrastructure, and that's potentially going to present a problem both in making this a highly contentious area and also potentially for the UK government having to attract other forms of investment that's likely not going to be domestic. So I think the UK government has created a bit of a quagmire for itself there.
And Amina Dilda, on the EU side?
Yeah, on the EU side, the challenge is not just within the EU member states that are signed up to the Belt and Road Initiative and the sorts of inward investment that they've already received. The EU also has the additional challenge of a lot of our neighbouring countries, countries like Serbia, Albania, and countries that are looking to ascend to the EU that have to grapple with Belt and Road initiatives and Belt and Road projects that don't necessarily meet EU environmental standards or let alone the other issue, of course, of national security and having exposing your critical infrastructure. I think it's a serious challenge. The EU wants to keep China. The EU clearly wants to use climate diplomacy as a way of keeping the door open with China. Xi Jinping had a meeting with Merkel and Macron. It's very few leaders are able to call what would be the two most powerful European leaders kind of into a call, albeit, you know, we know that Merkel will finish in September this year, and we know that Macron is facing a presidential election. But that still means something. You can say a metaphor that you could use is the EU is going to have to tread lightly and carry a big stick. They're going to want to make sure that they don't damage their relationship with China, especially when it comes to energy, to emissions. But in the same light, they don't want to overexpose their energy infrastructure to Chinese investment because of the absolutely crucial role that energy has in keeping the entire economy switched on.
Thank you. I think that's a good note to end on. Quite a challenge to the EU. Certainly, the European Parliament is often criticised as doing exactly the opposite of that Roosevelt maxim in shouting very loudly and waving a pea shooter. But that was a very interesting discussion. Thank you both, Lila and Amina Dilda, and thanks to everyone for joining. If you have any follow-up questions, please do contact us directly and enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks very much.
For more insights, blogs and analysis, you can visit our website www.global-council.com and subscribe to our mailing list. And you can follow us on Twitter @global_council.